You are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It is Monday, February 7th, 2022. My name is Sam Steeder. This is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, Ryan Cooper, national correspondent at The Week, author of How Are You Going to Pay for That? Smart Answers to the Dumbest Questions in Politics. Also on the program today, U.S. COVID deaths top 900,000. Daily death still over 2,500 as Omicron infections slowly across the country recede. Meanwhile, Russia has now amassed 130,000 troops at the Ukrainian border as talks continue to avert war. Government funding ends in 11 days. House prepping another punt, i.e. continuing resolution. Speaking of House members, Jim Clyburn pushing an anti-union Supreme Court nominee super hard. Heavily invested in that outcome. Republicans all in with January 6th being a legitimate political discourse. Meanwhile, Mike Pence unsheathes the dagger. Republicans suing against mail-in ballots in swing states across the country. However, the North Carolina Supreme Court strikes down the Republican gerrymander there. Spotify standing by Joe Rogan amidst his apologies for past racist remarks. And rest in peace to Todd Gitlin, early SDS president. All this and more on today's Majority Report. It is Monday. Joining me, as she does every day, not the least of which, the first day of the week, Emma Vigeland. Hello, Emma.
Hello, Sam.
Let's do a show fart. It's got a IM from Brooklyn Sue. Suggesting a shofar to mark the passing of Todd Gitlin. He was one of the earliest, maybe number two president of the SDS back in the day. Led, I think, some of the first anti-war, anti-Vietnam protests of that organization and anti-apartheid protests of that organization back in the mid-60s. I knew him personally a little bit through Air America. Maybe I'd interviewed him a couple of times. And around Occupy, he was doing some work and he reached out and we had a couple of drinks over the course of a couple of months. Good guy, very, very invested in left-wing politics, had a lot of, I think, you know, issues with various strains that came out of the SDS. Certain inevitability, as far as I could tell, with that. But passed away after, I think, what was a fairly brief illness starting in December. But this is for Todd Gitlin. ...79 years old. All right, let's go into... we got a lot to talk about today, but let's start with... I don't know, is this the... I mean, I feel like the 2024 Republican primary started some time ago, but it is really starting to heat up. And what's interesting here is that I think Mike Pence must have a sense that he's not going to be Donald Trump's running mate. Mm. And if you're not going to be Donald Trump's running mate, then you might as well be his rival. I think it's one of those situations for Mike Pence.
Be the rival or the people who my followers want to kill or all those sorts of things. Pick, to pick your poison.
And I think this is probably more a function of Mike Pence getting a sense that he cannot win over certain elements of the Trump base than a sense that Trump is in some way weakened.
Well, he's in a no-win situation, right? If they're all mad at him for not overturning the election, so you might as well, I guess, lean into it a little bit because you're already excommunicated by that.
I think that's what it is, yeah. And I think so, and you should. I've seen a little bit of this, not a lot, but the analysis that this is Mike Pence seeing a weakness in Donald Trump. No, I think it is more of what Emma has said, which is the die is cast. Pence is not going to win over those people who were chanting, "Hang Mike Pence." My hope is he wins over no one else.
It seems like that makes sense. You're not going to win over the people that wanted to kill you.
If Donald Trump came out the next day or came out tomorrow and said, "I got to tell you, actually, I've looked at it, and Mike was in a tough spot. And so he's okay. I'm good with the God Squad people." That's what he needed Pence for. And but here's Mike Pence at giving a speech to the Federalist Society in Buena Vista, Florida. And interesting, he's doing it to the Federalist Society, sort of in many respects reminding him like it was my peeps who were really concerned about the Supreme Court justice. Part of that credit goes to McConnell, who opened the door. And then the other part of that credit goes to me, who delivered those folks who want to turn this into a theocracy. And knew one of the ways to do that was to get two or three Supreme Court picks. And alas, but here he is.
"But there are those in our party who believe that as the presiding officer over the joint session of Congress, that I possess unilateral authority to reject Electoral College votes. And I heard this week that President Trump said I had the right to overturn the election. President Trump is wrong."
Pause it for 1 second. Now, I find it hard to believe that Mike Pence heard this for the first time this week.
I was about to say, did he just wake up out of like a 14-month coma?
Honestly, they must have taken a poll or something in terms of like his Pence's likability, or maybe there was funding shifted from somewhere. Maybe somebody from the Koch brothers organization came to Pence and said, "We're willing to give you this type of cash if you're willing to try and take, like, you know, I don't know, 4 or 5%, 8% from that solid 35 that he has."
That's very unfair. I mean, when you see him speak, he oozes sincerity. He would never do something like that.
Mike Pence, yes. You know what's also interesting is to watch, like, he is adopting George Bush's cadence.
Yeah.
And sort of like the...
He does the, like, "I'm very sincere" squint that I cannot stand.
That is actually media training that they tell
you. It's like
Bill
a news
Clinton
anchor
had
thing.
That, too.
Yeah.
Yeah, it is a way of showing people that you're really, really caring about them. Mm.
"I'm listening.
Tell me more." Okay, let's hear more of Mike Pence.
"And I heard this week that President Trump said I had the right to overturn the election. But President Trump is wrong. I had no right to overturn the election. The presidency belongs to the American people and the American people alone. And frankly, there is no idea more un-American than the notion that any one person could choose the American president. Under the Constitution, I had no right to change the outcome of our election. And Kamala Harris will have no right to overturn the election when we beat them in 2024.
Well, man, then you can make it scary, because then the Democrats can do it, and you know who would overturn it.
Kamala. Who's going to beat them, Mike?
That's right. We? I don't know if we are, Mike.
I wonder, you know, it wouldn't surprise me. Pence just goes to DeSantis and said, like, I'll be your number two.
Yeah.
I got another 8 years, like... This is, I mean, you know, Pence has got to be like, I don't want a job where I actually have to work.
And he feels so much cozier as a number two, right? He's like such a authoritarian lackey. He needs a strong man to follow.
He also, again, can regain his position as the most powerful theocrat in the country. So there's Mike Pence coming out. It'll be interesting to see if there's any reaction to that. Amongst the wing nuts.
And by the way, about DeSantis, I don't even know if DeSantis would take him. He's kind of damaged goods at this point.
Yeah. Oh, Mike, retread, Mike. Retread, Mike.
Maybe you can...
Sloppy seconds. Sloppy sentence seconds there, DeSantis. Sorry, Ron.
I found out your name means like something like pennies.
How awesome would it be if he was like, I'm running against... Now, you don't declare who your nominee, your vice president is until after the nomination. But it's Ron and re-Ron. All right.
There you go.
Maybe Kristi Noem will take you, Mike.
Here we go. Folks, a couple of sponsors for today's program. We all deserve to know what we're putting in our bodies and why. Well, Ritual, which is my brand of my multivitamin, offers clean, vegan-friendly multivitamin. It's formulated with high-quality nutrients in a bioavailable form so that your body can actually use. You're not going to find any sugars, no GMOs, major allergens, no synthetic fillers or artificial colorants. Plus, the fresh taste and delayed-release capsule makes taking your vitamins easy. Ritual delivers high-quality nutrients, including vitamin D3, in just 2 daily pills. Multivitamins should contain key nutrients in forms that your body can actually use to help fill the gaps in diet. No shady extras. It's available for women, for men, and for teens. Ritual multivitamins are scientifically developed to help support different life stages. And, well... without giving away too much, I am using the over 50 multivitamin. And for me, I will say this. There have been different times in my life where it's been suggested to me by my doctor to take vitamins, a deficiency in vitamin D, mm-hmm. you know, or, you know, one or two others. But the D has always been the main one that has dogged me.
D is important these days.
Super important. Not just, I don't know what the latest is in terms of COVID, but basically they say D is really important for maintaining, is it prostate cancer? I don't know what it is, but it's helpful. And for me, what would always happen is I'd go get my multivitamin. I would take it religiously. The bottle would get empty. And then I would forget to refill it. And then boom, like 6 years later, I'm like, God, I almost had it.
Yeah.
That has changed. And why? Because with Ritual, your multivitamins are delivered to your door every month with free shipping. It's easy to start, snooze, or cancel your subscription at any time. And in terms of Ritual, if you don't love it after your first month, you can cancel. They'll refund your first order. But for me, like, the big thing is my vitamin D levels, according to my doctor, good. It's really, I don't know, maybe the first time was probably a year ago. He said, like, what's going on?
Mm-hmm.
And it's because I don't run out of vitamins. When I do, I get my next one.
Mm.
You would think that wouldn't be such a big deal, but it is for me. Get your key nutrients without the BS. Ritual is offering my listeners 10% off you during your first 3 months. Visit ritual.com/majority to start your Ritual today. Also, I've been using... Grove now for a couple of years, more than that. That was my go-to during the lockdown.
Right.
What is Grove Collaborative? Well, they're basically a one-stop market for cleaning and, I guess, what they call beauty products.
Yeah.
Is that what they call
it? Yeah.
Personal hygiene products. And it's all green stuff. So you don't want to use single-use plastics. Well, by 2025, Grove is going to be 100%. All of their products are going to be 100% plastic-free. Laundry care, hand soaps, dish soaps. Grove carries hundreds of products aimed at replacing single-use plastics across every room of your home and your head-to-toe personal care routine. That's what I was looking for, personal care routine. Grove's concentrated cleaners in refillable glass bottles are friendlier to the planet and twice as effective as the leading natural brands. And over 2 million households already rely on Grove for safe formulas and refillable packaging that never compromises on performance. My kids are not small anymore, but if they, you know, like, this would have been a blessing.
Right.
Had my kids been tiny, you know, when they were babies, you're really uptight about this stuff. But I use the Grove Orange, maybe it's Orange Rosemary or Orange something concentrate. I've got multiple bottles of that that I spray around. I use now every one of my hand pumps is refillable hand soap. The kids get the pineapple foaming kind. All Grove products. I also still like seventh generation that they have because right. I like 90% of the stuff I get scent free. But they also have toilet paper, bamboo style toilet paper. I mean, it's good stuff. Go to grove.com/majority today. Get a free gift set worth up to $50 with your first order. Plus, shipping is fast and free. Get started right now at grove.com/majority. That's grove.com/majority. Check it out. They have all sorts of products there, and they are much better for the environment. All right, and as always, we'll put those links in the YouTube and podcast description, and it's your support that makes this show possible. If you want the free show, free of commercials, become a member. Join themajorityreport.com. And well, want to welcome back to the program Ryan Cooper, national correspondent at The Week, author of How Are You Going to Pay for That? Smart Answers to the Dumbest Questions in Politics. I really like that. What is the subtitle, Ryan? Thanks for joining us. Really appreciate that.
Glad to be here. I will have to confess I didn't write the subtitle, so I can't confirm necessarily that the answers are smart, but I hope they're smart.
Well, but the questions are certainly dumb.
Yes, they are.
As long as we can agree on that. Here with Emma Vigeland, of course. So let's just start with what... Let's start with... And I feel like, you know, I have had, over the years, many, many debates with libertarians about a lot of the topics that you cover in this book. But let's start with that first sort of, I guess... myth or what you call a self-immolating idea that is has really woven itself into the fabric of our political consciousness in this country.
Yeah, so that the idea of, you know, what Carl Polanyi would say, the self-regulating market, a just sort of commonsensical notion that the economy is this pre-political entity, you know, the economy is something that you need to sacrifice yourself to. And thus the sort of, you know, ironic name of the book, how are you going to pay for that? Because the implicit assumption behind that question is that the government is an imposition on the economy, that you need to allocate, you know, all of your spending with taxes beforehand. Because basically, the government is a sort of like quasi illegitimate imposition on the economy, which is created through the private actions of individuals, specifically business owners, usually. And the fundamental reality, to simplify it only a little bit, is to say that the economy is a government program. It's created and sustained at every turn by government policy. And most fundamentally, you know, it's a collective enterprise. Everybody has a role to play in it. And there are, there's always choices that can be made, you know? And so the libertarian move there that you're talking about is to limit the terms of debate such that like, their preferred conclusion is like automatically produced. You know, it's never like, is government borrowing good or bad? It's how are we, what is the best way to reduce it? You know, it's begging the question in the technical, like logic sense. You know, the libertarians love the list of fallacies on Wikipedia, and there's one for you. You know, you're assuming the conclusion in the argument. You know, it's a dishonest presentation. And so I'm trying to, like, it's a pretty obvious idea once you sort of like really think about it for a minute. Obviously, the government has something to do with like the dollar existing and banks and roads and bridges and trains and all the stuff that it builds, you know, and like the military. These things are all important, of course. But when you really think about it, it's hard to internalize given the level, the amount of, you know, basically propaganda that we all sort of internalize, sort of nurtured from birth about this sort of stuff. You know, even today you crack it open, the New York Times or the Washington Post, and you'll often see stuff about how, well, inflation's bad, and that means we're all just going to have to accept a recession because there's only one way to, you know, handle these sort of things. And so, you know, I'm trying to give people a nice, concise little way of avoiding that pitfall.
What is the trajectory? Like, I'm trying to think of like what the trajectory of this idea that the economy is, you know, exists in nature, and the U.S. government decides to engage in the economy, and our societies decide to engage in the economy as if it's like the weather. And, you know, the best we can do is occasionally have an umbrella and be able to tell you that rain may be coming or not. And that's about it, as opposed to we own the weather machine. And we, you know, like you said, you've just gone through all the list of things that we engage in. We also constrain the human relationships, and we've changed that from time to time within this country, right? Like, we've imposed income taxes, we've passed Taft-Hartley, which fundamentally changed the way that labor and capitalists and management deal with each other, and not to the benefit of labor, I should add. But how do you track this? Was there a what's been the ebb and flow of the understanding of the economy like that, as opposed to like the way that you're arguing, which is that the economy is a political decision, essentially?
I think it's, you know, there's a certain sense in which it's a naturally appealing idea. I think people kind of can stumble into it of their own volition. You know, because it kind of is the case that in terms of the individual, you really can't do anything to change like the direction of the national or much less the global economy. It really kind of is like the weather for an individual person. Like you can maybe make some choices here and there. You know, especially if you're a member of like a collective organization, like a union, but you know, you can't like, change whether like a, you know, a history degree is less valuable than a computer science degree. You know, that's just a function of sort of how things work. But I think that the major explanation for this, and the reason why it's been so hammered into people's heads over the years, is that it's very convenient for rich people, basically, to for that to be the sort of conventional wisdom in the, you know, in the economy. And this goes all the way back to the Industrial Revolution in Britain. You know, you portray an economy which is incredibly brutal towards workers, you know, relies to a significant extent on child labor, you know, or sending like pregnant women down into the coal mines, as used to happen in the early industrial Britain, as that's just like a thing that, it's just a kind of natural and unavoidable feature of the way that, you know, human society functions, then the people who are making tons of money off the labor of those workers don't have to deal with any inconvenient regulations or unions that might, you know, obstruct their wealth and their, I think even more importantly, their control of the business. You know, the most convincing argument, and it was something I cite repeatedly in the book, is this essay, the Political Aspects of Full Employment by Mikhail Kalechki. And it basically goes into this, you know, this attitude in great detail. The fact that, you know, even when you're having a crisis like the Great Depression, business generally, they oppose efforts to deal with mass unemployment. And this is because it creates political changes that they don't like. You know, if the government figures out that they can, you know, they can create jobs whenever they want, and they can tax people whenever they want, and they can even, you know, expropriate a property if they want, that really dethrones the, you know, the capitalist business owner from his place at the top of the social pyramid, both in terms of riches and in terms of social status and self-regard and so forth. And that, you know, I think really explains how persistent this has been. You know, that it's really incredible to think about the rise of neoliberalism after like almost the exact same ideas almost destroyed, you know, all of Western civilization in the Great Depression. You know, Hitler was a product of the Depression. Worst war in history. And yet, you know, 40, 50 years later, you have people just going right back down the exact same track of deregulation and all the rest of it. So it's, you know, it's a strong idea, and it really, you know, even to this day, I think holds a great purchase over the minds of elites and the mass population together.
Has there ever been a time? I mean, is it like the only time, like I'm thinking, at least in the 20th century, may have been sometime around like the end of the 60s, where, you know, people were saying everybody's a Keynesian now. On some level, was an acknowledgement that we can make decisions in the context of, you know, regardless of what you think about Keynesianism or if it's a, you know, solution, on some level, there's some acknowledgement there that we have control over the economy in some fashion or another. But we should, you know, I also should say, like, you know, people assume, like, you know, a 40-hour work week. They assume, you know, like a time and a half. It's assumption that kids or pregnant women don't go into mines, or kids don't work in factories. And that was just not the case. It was just a decision that we made that, like, we're not going to do this, and we can make other decisions, I guess, is really what it is. But it's been also both parties. I mean, Bill Clinton in the 90s was saying, you know, we're going to make government leaner and we're going to get out of the way, essentially, after Reagan. And so both parties have participated in this delusion. Oddly enough, only when Barack Obama said you didn't build that was some tepid attempt at sort of acknowledging that, like, hey, wait a second. This is, we have what you call collective economics.
Yeah, I would say you're definitely right about the post-New Deal period. Like, basically from the mid-30s to about the mid-70s, you had a consensus that some kind of economic management was not only necessary, but unavoidable. And so, you had a lot, like a vast regulatory state, a huge antitrust system, you know, ways like, the realizing that the market, even the market institutions don't run themselves. You know, this requires state policy for competition to happen, and especially competition to happen along the things that you want. Competition about price and quality, rather than competition just trying to run the other guy out of business and then set up a monopoly and gouge the supplier or the customer. that, you know, I think maybe the most striking example is capital controls in the Bretton Woods system, which was is kind of a hodgepodge. But, you know, that was so deeply implicated in the Great Depression. The flows of financial capital, just hot money going from one country to another, was how the contagion of the financial crisis in 1929, you know, spread from New York to Europe and back again, you know, and was recognized as incredibly dangerous by virtually everyone. Like, no serious economist would deny that. You know, you could say cross-border investment, that's one thing, but having hot, you know, speculative derivative trading and stuff going across borders, that is just like totally unacceptable. And there were very tight capital controls that lasted for about 30 years until Bretton Woods was broken apart and most of these regulations were like picked off one by one. The other thing to say about that, though, is that, you know, the reason I call it a self-immolating idea is because it's totally impossible to have an actual self-regulating market. Like, all economies are run with choices. And that was true with Britain in the 19th century. It was true neoliberalism in the, you know, the 1990s. These were things that were set up with structures of policy. They required, you know, active management at every point. And, you know, often the management of, you know, the most coercive parts of the government, namely the police and the army. You know, the way that the British set up their, you know, great economic empire was with, you know, gunboats and you know, invading armies and colonial administrators and stuff to, you know, dispossess the, you know, Indian cloth manufacturers and force China to take in lots of opium and basically destroy the Chinese empire in the process. And, you know, so it's even kind of hard to think about, but you have to keep in mind that like this idea of it even being possible to like deregulate the economy in any serious way is basically out of the question, unless you're talking about a descent into total anarchy or something, a zombie apocalypse. You know, there's your deregulation. But otherwise, you're just talking about which choices. What choices do you want to make? And you can, you know, you can make lots of different ones. Some of them are bad. You know, even sometimes, you know, you can make bad regulations, of course. You can make bad choices in that direction. It's not, you know, like just because it's a regulation means it's good. But like, you know, there's no way of evading the trap, you know. And anybody who says that, like Clinton, you know, saying like, oh, we're going to, the era of big government is over and we're all Reaganized now, what, you know, all the rest of that rhetoric is just a way of camouflaging the political agenda of somebody, usually, you know, the business class typically.
And camouflaging the self-serving nature of it too. Like, I mean, without I guess big picture question to you is, without like these shocks to the system, like the Great Depression or the recession, which is like when you see some of the cracks in this, like Sam was saying with Obama, hinting at like maybe abandoning the orthodoxy of neoliberalism, and like before, you know, in the wake of the Great Depression, this more widespread embrace of Keynesian economics. Isn't it always going to revert once things are fairly stable and the power brokers kind of like maybe regulate themselves to a bit to a larger extent under capitalism, or there is more regulation? Then once things get a little better, okay, it's time to go back to free markets. It's time to loot a little bit more for ourselves. Is that not kind of, it sounds a little nihilistic, but under free market capitalism, and if we're so committed to that, isn't that kind of how things are going to go?
I think it depends. You know, the sort of general conclusion I have, you know, to a lot of questions like this is like, it depends. But it's an open political issue. It's a jump ball, you might say. And you definitely do see right now an attempt to reimpose the old, you know, hegemonic system of the post 2008, because that was so good for owners of businesses. You know, you got basically free profits. Workers' wages were flat. Interest rates were low. Growth was terrible, but no, they don't care about that kind of thing. And this high inflation and possibly higher interest rates coming up, and especially low unemployment and wages shooting up at the bottom, is worker shortages and all kinds of industries. People hate that. And so there has been a definite resort to this kind of naturalizing rhetoric that, like, oh, inflation is proof that we have offended the gods of the self-regulating market. It's time to pull our horns in and, you know, increase interest rates and basically, you know, the camouflaged agenda there is that we need to beat the workers back into submission. The you know, Reddit anti-work stuff is being covered on CNN. You know, we can't be having this kind of thing get out of hand, you know, much less, you know, imagine, I mean, the thing that they fear the most in the business community would be a mass union organizing drive that really takes fire across multiple industries. Because they know that once people like get some confidence and start thinking that, like, well, I don't just have to accept my lot in life, then that's a real threat to the status, the power, and the income of the, you know, the business class. And so, I would say it really depends on, you know, what Biden does, what Democrats do, what people in the media, you know, it's like, it's a thing that, it's a narrative that can be pushed and we've seen it be very successful. But on the other hand, you know, I think that, you know, 2008 was took the shine off of deregulated Wall Street for sure. And, you know, we've seen in the pandemic, it's like, oh, when things are bad, you know, we could just send everyone in the country just about a check for $1,200. And it was actually fine. You know, a little inflation later, but, you know, the other countries that didn't stimulate like that are still having inflation now for whatever reason. And so I think that if we can preserve the memory, especially of the pandemic responses, and to remind people that, like, the government can just give you money, you know, and, like, that's nice. You know, bank account balance go up, and that, like, this is a choice that we can make, that we don't have to, you know, contort ourselves into, you know, whatever the position that the, you know, venture capitalists want. It's a choice.
It seems to me at this moment, it's really, really important to keep that what you just said in mind in terms of inflation. To the extent that our inflation numbers are any different than around the world, it's minimal. That the real issue that is impacting everybody is supply chains, is COVID. But the wage increases are real. Those are much harder to roll back because people are not going to continue to work for the same job for less pay. That's just people mentally just aren't going to want that. At least in the short term, you could theoretically fire those people and then hire new people at lower pay. But the idea is, you know, we want our government to do things to help lock in, those pay increases. And part of that is to pursue policies that don't put a cap on employment, that don't create an artificial ceiling. And it just as you were talking earlier about the sort of making these decisions or being conscious of that primary assumption that the economy is a function of our decisions, always. Always, always, regardless of what the economy is doing at any point, it is a reflection of decisions we've made. I've heard this over the years many, many times. We don't want government to choose winners and losers. It always chooses winners and losers. If someone's not talking about it choosing winners and losers, it probably means they're the winner in the choice that's being made. Same thing with redistribution of wealth. The government always redistributes wealth. It's just a question of in which way is that wealth redistribution going to flow. And you have a great line where you talk about what it means to own something in this country is who has the greatest claim to the state's monopoly of power or violent authority. And you talk about proprietarianism. What is that term?
That is a term I stole from Ursula K. Le Guin. In the novel The Dispossessed, just kind of like the sound of it. Thomas Piketty has a similar word, proprietarianism, but I like mine better, or, well, Ursula K. Le Guin's. But the idea there is that, you know, this is about, you know, as Piketty says, the sacralization of property, treating property as a sort of sacred object that can't be, you know, fiddled with, that like, you know, has to be the sort of foundation stone of the entire social order. You know, obviously appealing idea for rich people who own lots of property. But yeah, I think, you know, property is almost the most interesting part to sort of dig into the socially constructed nature of all economies, because, I mean, you think about it, you know, at a certain point, surely, you know, in like prehistory or before human beings even existed, there was no property at all. Like the anyone was free to go wherever they wanted. And, you know, at least, I mean, you might be eaten by a jaguar or something, but you didn't, you know, there wasn't a sort of system of fences that would tell you that this piece of ground is mine, that piece of ground is yours. You know, that these were invented. And, you know, you think like everything in the world, all the objects, all of the pieces of computer equipment and stuff that we're using to talk to each other right now, all that is made out of natural stuff that, you know, once was not the property of anybody. It had to be dug up out of the ground. You know, it was created in the supernova billions of years ago. And so, you know, when you look at like how property came to exist in the first place, it was not at all subtle about it being a violent taking from the rest of people. I mean, that, you know, you just read some history going back, you know, as far as history goes, and it's just one group of people conquering and killing the other group and taking their land, you know, and often enslaving the population. And that, you know, is how property came to be in this country. There was a, you know, there were people living here. Some of them had sort of like quasi-territorial systems, but nothing like a modern property register, you know, sort of collective ownership, you might say. But then we came in, we killed all those people, and we set up, you know, on almost all of the land, a system of property. And it's just built from the foundation, the politics of raw violence, the sword and the club. You know, what property is and what it always has been is you set up a system where you say, this is mine. And if you disagree, you try to take it from me, I'm going to kill you. I'm going to enjoin you in the courts, or I'm going to get the police to come and drag you violently off of my property. And so property is access to the state's violent capacity, to its police and its soldiers, you know, that you have a property register, and you know, you can access that. You can call 911 and you will get people to respond. You file a lawsuit and you get the state to respect your lawsuit. You know, that's not to say that property is totally illegitimate all the time. You just have to recognize that it's a social construct. And in every case, it's at the root of dispossession, theft, violence, and genocide. And so, you know, the idea that it could be sacred is to be fairly disgusting. You know, you should use it on behalf, in my view, on behalf of the general welfare of all the people.
And I want to get to that concept of it. I just want to hang here for a moment, because this is also, you know, this idea of a monopoly of force by the government being in direct contradiction to the notion of property rights, like, or having a problem with the monopoly of force being in contradiction to the notion of property rights. That is a real problem for when libertarians, if you dig a little, like 3 inches down, this is, becomes problematic for them. And it's also fascinating because I've had, I think it was Walter Block, I think it was, who was on, who, when I was like, if you start to just go back in terms of property rights, the idea of property rights start not necessarily with the Constitution in this country, but more when Europeans came over and started to work the land. And that's where we're going to start, where would property rights begin, and which is very convenient. Like it's, you know, more or less like, I don't know, getting to the top of, you know, a sports game and then saying like, you know, the rules, you know, I'm the best right-handed batter. So for now on, we're only going to include right-handed batters in the stats. And I'm in charge of it. And that's basically it, or something to that effect. But let's talk about the other choices that we could make. Once we acknowledge that our economy is simply a series of political choices that we make, let's talk about the other vision of what an economy we could measure a good economy by, or, you know, what the goal could be.
Yeah, in the sort of second half of the book, I have a number of proposals. You know, we couldn't probably don't have time to go through all of them right now, but
that's why people got to read the book.
Yeah. Order from your preferred literature distribution facility. I think maybe an interesting one that Americans aren't quite as well versed in. You know, I talk about Medicare for all. That's a pretty prominent idea. But I have a reworked and updated version of my paper that I wrote for Matt Brunig, called the Leisure Agenda. And so, you know, I'd just like point out that, Americans work more, compared to the wealth of our economy than any other country in the world. You know, so, obviously a lot of poorer countries work more hours than Americans do. But if you sort of plot a chart of, hours worked versus wealth, America will be the farthest from the trend line, so to speak. Concretely, if we worked as much as I think Germans are in last place, the laziest country on earth, worked the least hours on average, we'd have something like 11 and a half weeks of extra vacation every year. So that's a very substantial amount of vacation. And, you know, you look at the history of this, you know, you get into the OECD statistics and you go back to like 1970, America was about average compared to peer countries in Europe. You know, Sweden, Denmark, France, Germany. And you know, what happened over the years, the last 50 years, basically, is that all of those countries decided to work less. They had, they put in a mandatory paid vacation days for all, you know, all regular employees. They got paid sick leave and they got more of it, and they got paid maternity leave, and, you know, they add in more like bank holidays. And, you know, it was essentially a choice to, you know, take the wealth that they were accumulating through the process of like economic growth and take some of that, not in the form of more money, but just in terms of more time, more free time to, I mean, basically you go to Europe in July, all of Northern Europe empties out and they go down to Greece and Italy, you know, and just to have a good time. 'Cause it's like, what's the point of being rich if you can't enjoy it, you know? And America just didn't do any of those things. And so while all their trend lines were going down since 1970s, USA is just flat. We're working about the same as we were back in 1970, even though, you know, we're about something like twice as rich. And it's like, why? There's a culture of overwork that penetrates way, way up into the income ladder. Some of the people who work the most hours are some of the wealthiest people, you know, Wall Street bankers or Silicon Valley, tech guys, you know, video game developers or software engineers and stuff. Some of these people work crazy hours. And, this is a political choice. This is something that we could get rid of if we just, you know, change the way that the laws worked. And made it, you know, enforced things like a 37 and a half hour work week, a mandatory overtime pay for, you know, people who do, more than 40 hours or 37 and a half. You know, there's a whole menu of options I lay out in there. And I think it speaks to the, you know, just sort of the way that, you know, you need to kind of stay on top of things. You know, you got to update your economy, not just be dealing with, you know, sort of a leisure time, a beta test or whatever from back in 1970, because, you know, then you're just piling up money that you never even get to spend.
When you make that comparison with Germany, where if we worked commensurate with our wealth as a nation, if we worked what they did, we got to their sort of dynamic, I guess we would have 12 weeks of vacation, which sounds very, very enticing to me. Is that productivity relative to GDP? I mean,
particular comparison, that's just hours. We work like 1750 something hours on average. You know, you take hours worked divided by the number of workers, and Germany works about 500 hours less than that. The way to measure, I think, productivity in this context would be GDP per hour worked. So you're not just like USA is much richer, but in terms of GDP per capita than most European countries, not Norway because they have a lot of oil. But then if you account for hours, basically, among major economies that aren't distorted by like resource rents, like Norway, which is like cutting edge rich and then has a bunch of oil money on top of that. So they're just insanely wealthy. USA, Germany, and France are like the cutting edge, the most productive economies. And so that I think is a fair representation of where we would go if we were sort of following the trend of countries with comparably productive economies. We would be working that much, like about 500 hours less per year.
And that's but that's really about redistributing the wealth, right? I mean, it's basically like saying, you know, we've got some cash hoarders in this country who are sitting on a tremendous amount of the wealth. And therefore, as a worker in the United States, we need to work. We need to get more money to pay for just some basic stuff that in these countries they don't have to pay for. Right. Like, I mean, yeah. Healthcare and pre-K or daycare, or there's a whole host of different things that the government is paying for by redistributing more aggressively the wealth that they accumulate as a country.
Yeah, I would say specifically with the leisure time stuff, what you're talking about is not creating the wealth at all. You know, so you're just working less and having less production and having just like more free time. And that, I mean, in a sense, you could say that's wealth. I mean, what's the most valuable thing? What's the thing that nobody could ever make more of ever? Time. You know, you're going to live as long as you're going to live, and there's nothing you could do about that. In terms of like, you know, making more minutes in the day. As far as the rest of it, you're absolutely right. You know, you look at the tax level in this country, we're something like, you know, 20 percentage points below, the Nordic countries or France. Germany is a little bit below the sort of leaders in that respect. And yeah, you know, their resources are collectively harnessed in a way to provide those things that in the United States people have to either pay for out of pocket or go without. And you're exactly right. Childcare, healthcare is the big one. And we could get into that if you want. You know, we pay so much for that in taxes and then a bunch more money on top of that in private payments. Child allowance, you know, pensions for retired folks. The panoply of basic welfare state stuff, and that, you know, and it does. I mean, especially because the economies are so much more equal, especially in the Nordics. That means taxing not only the rich, but also, you know, the middle class and the working class. People have to pay, you know, they just get taxed like crazy over there. You know, you got your VAT, you got your payroll tax. on the employer side and the worker side, all kinds of stuff. But, you know, the thinking is, and the reality is, you're getting that money back. It's one point or another. I mean, unless you're some kind of business titan, you know, there's a great tweet from the @Sweden, Twitter account that I refer to every now and then from this fella who, you know, they give it to a random Swede every now and then, which is, seems kind of crazy to me, but I guess that it works for them. And, there's a guy taking pictures of his birth. Him and his wife had triplets. And it was very, you know, it's expensive, delivery. You know, they ended up being in the hospital for like a month, and he's sitting there holding his three babies on his chest. And he was talking about, I realized at this point I was getting back every krona I ever paid in taxes and then some. And that's the dream, you know, that like you pay what you can, you know, in proportion to your income. And then when you need help, the government's there to catch you. And it's just like a much more safe and secure and, dare I say, free way to live.
Right. I mean, that is, in that instance, it's insurance, right? I mean, yeah. It's an insurance that that if you deal with an extraordinary, which happens to people every day, event, it's not going to destroy your life. You're going to be able to just deal with the actual event itself, not the expense. And then on a daily basis, your quality of life is just better because, I mean, one of the things that's not only better about, you know, let's say a single payer type of healthcare situation is not just that you're not paying exorbitant fees, you're paying a little bit less, so you're paying it out in higher taxes, but it's also just a system that is meant to actually deliver the service without making you jump through hoops and, you know, spend, like, those are the hours that you never get back. Like, you know, how am I going to pay for my kids' dental stuff? Well, it's going to involve forms in triplicate, and I filled out that one wrong, so I got to get it back. And this, you know, I mean, that's the quality of life is also a big bonus as well. Whether you're getting the dollars back, which inevitably will happen, but in the meantime, the process itself is much better.
Absolutely. Yeah, this maybe is the most underrated argument for universal healthcare, especially. I mean, we're all familiar with just the hell of bureaucracy you are in for. If you ever need medical treatment for anything, even if you have good insurance, you know, you gotta have your card. You got to go to the waiting area. You got to pay your copay, your co-insurance. Later on, you might get a bill, you know, for some probably illegal, you know, balance procedure. They recently issued some regulations about that, by the way, but there's a lot of holes in them. But, you know, fighting with the insurance company over the phone or fighting with the doctor over the phone, over like who's going to take the hit for this massive, you know, thing that whatever it was, and just the worry that creates, among everybody. You know, I remember reading an article from a couple of years ago about a woman in Boston who fell between the local, what is it? The MARTA, the train system out up there in Boston, fell between the platform and the train, and it like crushed her leg and like cut it down to the bone, just horrible injury. And people like pushed the train to the side and they got her out of there. And then she's crying saying, don't call an ambulance. I can't afford it. I mean, that just the people got this in the back of their head. I think a lot of the time, even if you're not, you know, really, even if you have good insurance, you know, you worry because it's logical to worry that you're just going to be just rooked. You're going to be taken for all you got. Possibly if you get very sick, and to just know that it's there and you don't have to do anything to access it, you know, like a friend of mine was in Britain one time and got, you know, was very sick, sort of delirious with fever and took a, you know, an ambulance ride to the hospital. And she was asking, when, you know, they're sort of like bundling her out of there into the urgent clinic or whatever it was, you know, she was like, what do I pay for it? And they looked at her like, oh, honey, we don't do that here. That like just, I mean, it's disgusting. It's uncivilized, you might say. And the, amount of, you know, unpaid work that we all have to do to become amateur insurance adjusters and amateur legislative specialists if you're on Obamacare, so you can know exactly which plan that you should be picking, because it's not obvious. It's an incredible hassle. And it's, you know, like I would pay another 10 points in taxes to just not have to deal with any of that stuff.
Oh my God. Absolutely. I mean, when you have a piece of legislation, and one of the major aspects is the creation of a navigator, a core of literally of navigators. Like, maybe this thing is a little bit too tricky. Like, you need people to actually literally be in charge of helping you figure out how you're going to get health insurance. It's just bizarre to me. But there's more good stuff in how are you going to pay for that. Smart answers to the dumbest questions in politics. Ryan Cooper, national correspondent at The Week, will put a link to that book at majority.fm. Thanks so much for your time today. Really appreciate it.
My pleasure.
Thanks so much.
Folks, just a reminder. And I probably won't have to say this many more times after this. Majority Live or MajorityReportLive.com. You can go to either one of those. The show in Brooklyn on March, what is it? 26th at 2 p.m. I know it's at 2 p.m.
Do you want me to write it down for you?
I know it's written down somewhere. It's already like half, maybe more than half sold. And we just announced it like 5 days ago. So get on it, folks. This is a smaller venue than the Wilbur in Boston. The Wilbur in Boston is also near peak. And we've got a ton of special guests. We haven't even announced our lineup yet for Brooklyn. But let's be honest. I mean, it's just a party. Oh, no, wait, that's in Boston. Mm. This is a party.
On majority.fm, there's only a link to the Boston live show.
What?
Yeah, we got to add. I mean, if you go to Majority Live, it seems like you can get both, but...
Wait, what? No. Did I screw that up? No. If you go to majoritylive.com...
No, that one is right. Yeah, I just meant our website.
Well, I don't know who's doing that.
Okay.
I did the Majority Live thing. I don't know who's in charge of the other thing. They screwed that up. No, Bradley can't tell. I'm looking at him right now.
I'm on it. I'm already trying to fix it.
I'm sorry. I didn't mean to call you out. I didn't even think that was your responsibility. Yeah, right.
I'll tell you what does work. Shop.majorityreportradio.com. That's our Shopify merchandise store. So if you run a business, you can supercharge your success with Shopify. It is the all-in-one commerce platform to start, run, and grow your business. Shopify gives entrepreneurs the resources once reserved for big business, so upstarts, startups, and established businesses alike can sell everywhere, synchronize your online and in-person sales, and effortlessly stay informed. Go to Shopify.com/majority, all lowercase, for a free 14-day trial. Get full access to Shopify's entire suite of features. Grow your business with Shopify today. Go to Shopify.com/majority right now. Do it right now. All right, we're going to head into the fun half in just a moment. Again, don't forget, justcoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. Use the coupon code MAJORITY, get 10% off. Get your tickets to the live Majority Report show. Matt, what is happening in the Matt Lekian Media Universe?
This weekend we released a patrons-only think tank, but go back, folks, and check out the long conversation we had with Matt Bender about his new show, The Scam Economy, where we talked about crypto, the new hit piece NFT scam, where some company just made... Did you hear about hit piece? They scraped Spotify's API, I think it's called, for all the names of albums and songs and stuff, and then they started selling NFTs of individual songs. And artists were like, "Hey, I didn't say you could sell my song as an NFT." And it was one of those classic cases.
I don't understand what that means.
It is You know, it's a very philosophical question because you can't like listen to the song. You just own the NFT that purportedly like has the album
you have
art
the receipt,
and the song name,
right?
And, yeah, exactly, on some registry. So they basically created a new registry of all song names and said you can claim the NFT of it. Very silly.
That's stuff. Like saying, so it's in other words, it's like, well, we're going to name all the stars. And I'm going to sell you the name of the star.
It's very
and
similar,
it's the most official.
I bet you there are star
NFTs. Star naming registry that exists. But couldn't I start my own NFT, like a competing one?
Yeah.
Well, the thing is like, so I thought it was just going to be a fiasco and blow up in their face. But Binder did a little bit more digging, and the guy has a recording industry background. And it looks like what they were trying to do is... basically, like, it's easier to say ask forgiveness than ask permission. Mm. And so they're just doing it, and then they're going to hopefully sell some and then go to the artist after they got the money and say, hey, you want in on this money that we got for selling an NFT of your...
But I don't even understand, like, what it is they're selling. If you're not getting the song, you're just getting the rights to say that you own the song?
Yes.
Yeah.
If without any of... Well, but why can't I also do that?
The NFT folks have a big problem with rights because they also bought a rare copy of Dune, I believe the book, and thought that allowed them to make like any sort of like movie based on it. But that's not how that works.
Could I sell the rights to the ownership of the Majority Report with just the NFT mm-hmm. of the Majority Report?
Yeah, I
mean,
somebody
could
have done
multiple
it.
Ones.
We could do Majority ones. We could do probably Hassan ones. We could do Pac-Man NFTs. We could sell NFTs of all.
I'd love to sell Pac-Man NFTs. Monetize his show. That's
so there's just
gonna...
like copyright does not exist in this world. But
well,
yes, it does.
It's not even copyright though. It's just it's not. You're
it's
not
commodification.
You're not really owning anything.
Yeah,
it's just
it's
the
vaporware.
Idea that you supposedly own it, right?
Yeah, I mean they'll find out copyright exists if they start making Disney NFTs. And
I still don't understand the concept of it. Well, with that said, though, I will also be on. I think Matt Binder's show Doomed tomorrow night.
Yes, so we heard.
You did?
Week. Yeah, he said that you were ironing out this.
So complicated right now with me doing anything, but it's his 200th show, so like the pressure's on.
Oh, yeah.
But I'm going to have like, I can't even, I'm going to have more than my own children that night.
What do you mean?
It's too complicated.
Is it a play date or something?
No, it's,
all right.
Forget it.
Your example of naming a star, that does exist. You can name a star on the Ethereum blockchain.
Oh, my God.
dstar.org.
I thought that was just like a romantic thing sometimes people
why,
did.
Why
like,
can't I name
got
a star?
You a star.
We're not even going to use the blockchain.
But
I'm just going to sell star names.
If it's not on the blockchain, then it's not, you know, does it really, it doesn't mean anything.
We will create a certification at the Majority Report. So you go around, you meet somebody who's like, oh, that's my star up there. And you just go, no, it's not. Here's the Majority Report certification that's whatever I named it.
But that's what's so good about the blockchain, because you can prove your ownership by being really wasteful with energy.
Yeah, well, you can prove your ownership when we start up our own certification by going to Majority Report, majority.fm, whatever it will be, / star certification.
Right.
And that's what we're going to do. That's the way. That's the new business venture that we're in.
All right, let's head into the fun half, shall we?
Maybe,
646-257.
I don't even have to do that now because I'm sitting on a pile of star certification cash. So I'm feeling it today. I'm going to start throwing around the big bucks.
Yeah.
Do fun half NFT.
There you go. All right, folks. I may even just like NFT of me saying 646-257-3920. You could own the fact that I said that. See you in the fun app.
You are in for it.
All right, folks. 646-257-3920. See you in the fun app.
Oh, no. Oh, no. Are you ready?
Who sent us this?
Anarchy. Alpha males are back, 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 boys back, and the alpha males are back, back.
just as delicious as you could imagine.
The alpha males are back, 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 boy, back. And the alpha males are back, 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 back.
Just want to degrade the white man.
Alpha males are back, back.
I take all of it to my throat.
Alpha males are back, 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 back.
Snowflake says what?
The alpha males are back, 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 back.
You are a madman.
And the alpha males are back, back.
Oh no, Sam Steeder, what a fucking nightmare.
Yeah, or a couple of them, just put them in rotation.
DJ Denner.
Well, the problem with those is they're like 45 seconds long, so I don't know if they're enough for the break.
That's fucking nonsense.
You see, white people doing drugs that look worse than normal white people, and all white people look disgusting.
And the alpha males,
psych, fuck them, fuck them.
Snowflake says what?
What?
Snowflake says what?
A hell of a lot of bank. A hell of a lot of bank. A hell of a lot of bank. Okay. I'm making stupid money. Hell of a lot of bank. A hell of a lot of bank.
Lives matter. Have you tried doing an impression on a college campus?
I think that there's no reason why reasonable people across the divide can't all agree with this. Psych.
And the alpha males are back, 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 back. And the Africans are black, 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 black African. And the alpha males are black, 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 black. And the Africans are back, 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 back.
When you see Donald Trump out there, doesn't a little part of you think that America deserves to be taken over by jihadists? Keeping it 100. Can't knock the hustle. Come on! Fuck them. Fuck them. Things I do for the bigger game plan.
By the way, it's my birthday!
My birthday!
Happy birthday to me, Jew boy!
I have a thought experiment for you.
And the alpha males are back, back. Africans are black, black. Alpha males are black, black. Africans are back, back.
Come on. What? Come on. What? Come on. Someone needs to pay the price for blasphemy around here.
I am a total
pussy.